So, of course, there's no sharp line between the two, and we will do some mathematics. So, quantum physics. So, and what we'll see, we'll actually see some of the mathematical tools that we used to do that. Are you doing the problems already? No, you're not supposed to do that. Okay. Okay, so what are we going to look at? So what is quantum physics? So quantum physics, so every most important theory in physics ever. So every single person here that does research does something related to quantum physics. That might not be the whole story, but they do something quantum. So what exactly is it? And I should say, sometimes you hear the term quantum mechanics or quantum theory. Really, they're basically the same thing. So I'll try and stick to quantum physics, but if you have quantum mechanics, if you've read about quantum mechanics in books, essentially, the way I'll be using it, the terms will be interchangeable. So quantum theory, quantum mechanics, quantum physics, same thing. So what is it? Where does it fit into the whole grand scheme of physics? Then we'll look at light, because the best, most up-to-date theory we have of light is a quantum theory. So we'll look at that. And then some experiments with some light and some photons and some mirrors. And just by some simple experiments with some mirrors and something which is kind of like a mirror but a slightly faulty mirror, we'll actually see and build up the basic core concepts of quantum physics. So this is what I want to do over the next really 2.5 days, to give you the stripped away essence. So we're going to distill down to about 3 or 4 points. And we'll actually see there are 3 of the most crucial key concepts in quantum physics. And we'll do some of the mathematics along the way. And this list here are, first of all, superposition, genuine randomness, wave particle duality, discreteness, and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So, and we'll see what they mean as we go along. If I could just... Okay, so generally, what is quantum physics? So I know a lot of you already know what it is, but so it's a scientific theory, it's primarily about tiny objects. And I'll explain a bit more what tiny is, I mean by tiny, because that's very vague and unscientific at the moment. Such as atoms, electrons, and protons. They make up all physical objects. Well, okay, I'll leave that for now. Make up all physical objects, how they move around and collide and impact with each other. So really, it's a theory about motion interaction. And so just as, for example, how electrons jump from one energy level to another and how they do it, what probabilities they have of doing that. And as they do, they either absorb or emit, give off radiate photons. And also, for example, how the americium atoms, the smoke detector you might have in your roof at home, how they and other radioactive elements actually emit radiation and decay. You're still doing the problem. Okay. So, I said tiny objects. What do we actually mean by tiny? So, for kind of a scale, that's a picture of me. It's pretty hard to see, but I'm 1.8 meters tall, 1.83 meters tall, which is 6 foot. So, go to something about 100 times smaller than me, you get to a centimeter. That's about the size of an ant. So, go 100 times smaller than that, we get to about a tenth of a millimeter, 10 to the minus 4 meters. So the scientific notation there. So just the minus 4 means we've got sort of the 4 zeros and then the 1. And we've got the decimal point there. So that's what the minus 4 is. So minus 5, 5 zeros, including the decimal point and the 1. And so that's really the same as 1 divided by 10 to the power 4, or 10 with 4 zeros, which is 10,000. So that's just the scientific notation. And when we get to that scale, we have a grain of sand. And that's about a grain of sand, speck of dust. That's about the smallest thing that I can imagine, can conceive in my mind. Well, I mean directly see. So we've got 1,000 times smaller than that, 10th of a micrometer, 10 to the minus 7 meters. We get down to the scale of a virus, a flu virus, the smallest things that's alive, living creatures. So if we go, and you can see those in microscopes, go down to 1,000 times smaller than that, then you get down to the level of a single atom. So too small to see in a standard microscope, if you have a special microscope, such as an electron microscope, you can actually see individual atoms, and they have microscopes you can see individual atoms in now. You get down 10 to the minus 10 meters, or a tenth of a nanometer. That's, roughly speaking, how big an atom is. And that's the scale of quantum physics. So by tiny, I mean something atom-sized or smaller. And if you, so that's really 10 billion times smaller than you. So the world's completely different. It's just strange, it's bizarre, doesn't make any sense. So if you shrunk yourself down, if you had this machine, a magic machine, you could shrink yourself down to 10 billion times smaller than what you are, you would be the size of an atom, and you would kind of live your life at the quantum world, and you would see a number of very, very strange things happening, such as particles appearing to be in two places at once, things just happening spontaneously for no reason whatsoever. And a number of other strange things, and such particles seeming to be instantaneously linked to each other, no matter how far apart they are, even if they're at opposite sides of the universe. So this is kind of the quantum world, and this kind of bizarre world is what I'd like to give you and explain you the core concepts of over the next little while. Okay, so just to kind of get an idea, now you can do the student activity, of just how small the quantum world is. So I was actually going to bring a Mars bar chocolate bar. Does everyone know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay, good. A Mars bar chocolate bar. So unfortunately I don't have one, but just to get an idea of how small an atom is, what I'd like you to do is figure out, roughly speaking, how many atoms would be in a Mars bar chocolate bar. So it's a simplified calculation. And what we're going to assume it's rectangular. And there are the dimensions there. It's 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter by 5 centimeters. Just this rectangle. And we'll assume that all atoms, you can see the assumptions there, have a radius of 10 to the minus 10 meters, and they're spherical. So from the radius, you can figure out the volume of an atom using the formula V equals 4/3 pi r cubed, where r is the radius, this value here. And so obviously, if you've got spherical atoms, there'll be little gaps between the two. Between adjacent atoms, but we'll ignore that for the moment, just do a simplified calculation. So, and often we do that in physics, this would be right to the right order of magnitude, so we don't need an exact answer, we just want a rough idea. So if you could start that now, and do you have calculators, or do you need calculators? Hands up if you need a calculator, or you'd like a calculator. Okay, one person.
Two.
Okay, can you catch? Okay. So we're just after a rough calculation here. Okay. And then if you could do your working on paper, and then when you have your final answer, if you could clean up your whiteboards and write them on. So I'm going to get you to put up your final answer on the whiteboards. There you go. So, I need you to do your... Could you do the working on paper? Okay, when I need the final answer on the whiteboard, I need to be big so I can see it from the front. So I'll give you 3 minutes. And look at the people around you, check your answers, see what they have. Yes? Cube, the button to cube, Michael. Maybe just modify the hat thing.
There's a little hat thing.
Okay.
Yeah. It also has a cube button on there. You know what the hat thing? Thank you.
Okay, we'll give you 2 more minutes. If you have that, I'd like you to get an estimate for the number of atoms that make up Perimeter Institute. And you need to justify any assumptions you make.
A Google Flex.
Google Flex?
Yeah.
Okay, justify it.
It's a big number.
That's more atoms than there are in the universe. Okay. Have you done the first one? What answer did you get? Okay, great. Okay, if everyone... Could you everyone raise up your answers to the first question? No. Okay, so... So that's roughly what the answer is. If you... Okay. So if I can have your attention, what we'll do is we'll just leave the second question about how many atoms there are in Perimeter Institute to one side for the moment, and we can come back to that later. So if you've got a different answer to that, it's probably just the powers of 10 with remembering that 1 centimeter equals 10 to the minus 2 meters and just centimeters to meters. That's, I suspect, where some people got something different. But, okay, so basically 10 to 24, that's a lot. Avogadro, of the order of Avogadro's number. So, I mean, an atom is, I mean, that just shows you how tiny an atom, I mean, a Mars bar, chocolate bar, 10 to 24. And 10 to 24 is really hard to imagine how many atoms that are, how big a number that is. Okay, so quantum physics currently is our best, science's best theory about the nature of the subatomic world. And one thing about quantum theory is phenomenally accurate. So it's been around for 80 years. It's been just tested to death. There have been thousands and thousands of experiments that have been done on it. And every single accepted experiment has agreed with quantum physics. So we have no reason directly to doubt it today. And in terms of some of the calculations, the results could predict certain things such as the magnetic moment of the electron down to 1 part in 10 billion. And so, just to give you an idea of how accurate that is, imagine, so a lot of you came from, or everyone from overseas came from Toronto Airport. So the airport where you landed, then you got the bus, the little shuttle, to here. So that distance is around about 100 kilometers. And so hopefully all those people from Canada will know the distance from here to Toronto. Toronto is about, just on the 401 highway, around about an hour's drive east. So it's about 100 kilometers away. And if you could predict, if you had a theory that could predict the distance from here to Toronto with the same accuracy as quantum physics predicts the magnetic moment of the electron, just how the electron spins around, it's got a little magnetic moment, a little like a tiny bar, South Pole magnet, and really the strength of that magnet is the measure of the magnetic moment. And if you could get the same accuracy in predicting the distance from here to the airport in Toronto, Toronto Pearson, you'd be correct within 1/100 of a millimeter. So that gives you an idea just how phenomenally accurate it is. But also, it's very weird. So it's a very, very weird theory. And even scientists whose job, their lives, is to work on it, it's very hard to get a really strong gut feeling for it or a picture of what's going on. You can kind of manipulate the mathematics, but it's very hard to get an intuitive feel for what's going on. And, I mean, you talk to anyone here, and even the people have been working on it again for years and years. I mean, I did my PhD and I spent 4 or 5 years working, thinking about it all the time. I don't really sort of feel like I understand in terms of the deep sense. So hear more about that, but I'd like to try and give you a feel for it. So what I should say is, at any time it feels kind of weird, it feels strange, you don't feel like you get it, then that's fine, that's normal. So you shouldn't be feeling bad. So, okay. So where does quantum physics fit into the big thing, picture thing? So if you think about 20th century physics, so that's last century. So the two big pillars of that, the four pillars, are roughly speaking the physics of very small quantum physics, subatomic stuff, So actually under quantum physics we have, so that describes three of the four main forces, electromagnetism, the weak and strong, so they're the two forces inside the nucleus. And on the other hand, we have the other second main pillar of 20th century physics is general relativity. So that's Einstein's theory of gravity. Really, that said, it's really a geometric view of gravity, that gravity, what mass and energy do, so objects like the star, actually kind of warp and distort space and time, just as if you have a trampoline and you get a bowling ball, you put it in the middle of a trampoline, the trampoline sort of sags down. And so just it kind of warps the surface. So just as that happens, Einstein said that all objects, all matter and energy, like the sun, like Earth, are actually kind of distorting or warping space and actually time around them. And that actually is what gravity is, just the warping of space and time. But that really applies kind of to large things. So by large, I mean galaxies, stars, black holes, nebulae, stuff like that. So we have kind of the physics of the small and the physics of the large on the other hand. And so in 17th century, Isaac Newton, I mentioned this on Sunday night, what he did was he came up with a universal theory of gravity. He came up with one single theory that worked for an apple falling from a tree, a tennis ball falling from a second-story building, and also the planet, the moon going around the Earth going around the sun. So it was a universal theory of gravity. So it applied to things way up in the sky and to things here on Earth. So it was very, very broad. And it's genius to actually, it's kind of, we take it for granted at some level today, but it was genius back at the time to think there was this one force, gravity, that applied to things way up in the sky and things on Earth, sort of celestial and terrestrial, so to speak, up in the sky and down here on Earth. And so it was just as that happens, you might wonder, is there a universal theory of quantum physics and gravity? So one theory that unifies them all. And so Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life working on something similar. He failed. So the last 30 years of Einstein's life were a failure. He didn't make any progress, really, in that. But today, having said that, that was an incredibly, incredibly tough problem. And like I mentioned on Sunday night, that's perhaps the holy grail of theoretical physics. So we have a lot of very, very smart people all over the world, universities everywhere working on this. And we're going to be hearing a couple of talks about this. And so the two promising approaches are, two of the most prominent theories are superstring theory and loop quantum gravity. So superstring theory, roughly speaking, the idea that instead of everything being made of atoms, if you look really closely at the atoms, they're essentially tiny, tiny vibrating strings. So everything. So stars, clothes, pens, what you ate for breakfast are actually made up of strings. And so that's superstring theory. It's really hard to get an idea of just how small these strings are. They're phenomenally, phenomenally small. Does anyone know the length of a string in superstring theory? Yep. Great. So, I mean, that's a number, and you say, well, 10 to the minus 35, gee, that's small. But no, it's not small, it's really small. So, I mean, an atom is small. This is 25 orders of magnitude smaller than an atom. And it's something, I forget the exact calculation, but if you figure out something like that, a superstring is smaller than an atom by about the same factor that a tree is smaller than the solar system, or an atom is smaller than the solar system. It's just incredibly, incredibly tiny. It's just really hard to imagine. So that's the one approach. And that's probably, would be fair to say, that's what, there are a lot of people working on that. And it'd be fair to say that's kind of the leading approach to a so-called theory of everything. Sort of a one-size-fits-all theory. So one equation you could write on a t-shirt, that will describe the entire physical universe in principle. So unfortunately, you can't put it on the t-shirt you're designing tomorrow because we don't have the actual equation because it seems to be a theory. Figure it out, yeah. So by all means. And so loop quantum gravity. So we have there are people in this building that work on superstring theory. And hopefully you meet some of them during the week. Oh, actually, one of them will be giving you a talk on Monday. So that's Sean Group talking. It's actually, he's giving the talk at E equals MC squared. And he's a string theorist, and you'll get to meet him. Loop quantum gravity, you'll hear some talks, two talks by people working on that, Lee Smolin and Fertini, Makupulu Kalamara. And that's sort of a different theory. And that sort of, in really, that's a theory about space and time at the quantum level. And that actually makes up space and time by tiny, tiny loops. Of flux that you actually find that kind of sort of weave together in a web that make up space and time. So that's loop quantum gravity, and I'm sure Lee will talk more about that. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to throw things out to you and ask you a question. And so this kind of idea of looking for one theory that describes the entire physical universe, this universal theory, this comprehensive thing. There are some different points of view on that. That's the dream of a lot of physicists, but do we actually know that it's possible? So this is Richard Feynman. He won a Nobel Prize for Physics in 1965 for work actually in the quantum physics of the electromagnetic force. And he said, people say to me, are you looking for the ultimate laws of physics? No, I'm not. If it turns out that there's a simple ultimate law which explains everything, so be it. That would be nice to discover. If it turns out it's like an onion, so the universe is like an onion with millions and millions of layers, then that's the way it is. So that's kind of expressing some skepticism that there might be an ultimate theory of nature out there. And the second was Brian Greene, who wrote the book The Elegant Universe, and also starred in the documentary of the same name. So those physicists believe that they've finally found a fabric for stitching these insights about the universe together into a seamless whole, a single theory that in principle is capable of describing all phenomena. So that's a more positive view about a theory of everything. So what I'd like to do now is to ask you, do you think a theory of everything is possible? So this is really, it's a very philosophical question. Physics does get into philosophy, and it's very open-ended. So there's obviously no right or wrong answer. Well, I mean, there is, but we don't know what that is. But the most important thing is if you do have an opinion on this, is to justify it and back that up. So this is kind of a skeptical position, kind of in line with know that there's probably not a theory of everything out there. So if you associate more with Feynman's point of view, or this more positively, yes, there is a theory of everything out there. So what I'd like you to do is to clean your whiteboards now, and then I'd like you to discuss, I'll give you 4 minutes with the people around you about whether you think a theory of everything is possible. It's possible to describe all the laws of nature in one law, one equation, one principle. And then, if I can have your attention, then all 4 of you, or the people around you, have to agree on one answer, and then I want you to write that answer on the whiteboard, and then we'll show that up. So the most important thing is not whether you write yes or no, because that's very simple, you can just write your 3 letters. The most important answer is you must rigorously justify is why you believe what you do. So it's argument. That's the way you go. Who's Einstein? Okay. Everyone write your answers down now. That's all four of you commit to, or all three. No, just yes or no. And then everyone can show up their answers. Okay. No, okay. Okay, we have some interesting answers. What? So I don't know if you can't see that, but... okay. So... Okay, so we had four groups that had on one whiteboard there.
Okay.
That's where we're putting on the t-shirt, sure.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, so... Great. So what we're going to do now is... So as I said, we don't know. No one knows what the answer is, but there are some people in this building, and their job, their life's passion, they've been working on this for 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, Lee Smolin, in some sense, or at least unifying quantum physics and gravity. That's his job. That's what he's passionate about, amongst other things. So what we're going to be looking at, we're kind of, in a sense, building up this. We really want to understand about this quantum theory of gravity. We've got to understand what quantum physics is and what gravity is. So let's start with the first one, quantum physics. So we're going to be looking at a thought experiment. And a lot of theoretical physics is like this. It's a key idea. And so Einstein thought about a lot of experiments. He wasn't a practical person. Didn't do a lot of experiments, but thought a lot about them. And this is really the essence of theoretical physics. And so when he was your age, when he was 16 years old, Einstein one day was daydreaming. And he daydreamed and thought, what would it be like if you could actually ride alongside a beam of light that was speeding away, obviously the speed of light? What would you see and what would the world be like? So if you get a flashlight at a laser point and you turn that on, the light obviously goes away, rushes away at 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second. It's the speed of light in space. And what would you see if you could move along like that? That's what Einstein thought about. And he didn't come up with a final answer. But he, 10 years later, when he was 25, in 1905, he developed and discovered his theory of special relativity, which is one half of his theory of relativity. And he said himself, there are quotes from Einstein saying, what got me started on the road to that theory was the thought I had when I was 16 years of age, what would it be like to ride alongside a speed of light? So I don't know what thoughts you're having when you're at your age, but maybe they're equally important. So that's one example of the thought experiment. And so it's not something you hear, but you think about. So what we're going to do is look at another thought experiment. So it's just a simple idea. But also, this is not totally detached from reality, because this experiment we're talking about, the simple network of mirrors and light and detectors. This experiment's been done many, many, many times. So it's a real experiment. There are real results. So to think about this, what is light made of? So imagine shining a flashlight at a wall. What happens? So we just get this spot of light on the wall. What happens if we make the flashlight dimmer and dimmer and dimmer? So less and less light goes on. And we have an array or a network of really sensitive detectors, just light detectors all around the wall. Just a whole bunch of them. So it's kind of hard to get the perspective at the walls here, and we're shining the flashlight directly at it. So what do we actually see? What is light ultimately made of? So we have this very sort of dim lot of light here. And so if we do that, what we end up seeing is the light tends, these detectors sort of go off at discrete times. So they see one bit of light coming through, and then there's a gap, they see another bit of light, another bit of light. So what it turns out is, so it's kind of like they're going off, and they say, yes, a bit of light came through, and then they wait a second, there's no light, then a bit of light goes through. And so what this suggests is that, so certainly is that light is made up of little kind of clumps or sort of bundles of energy or particles of light. And they have a special name, and they're called a photon, if you've heard of that. And yeah, that's the term photon down there. So this is what this particular experiment is saying about light. And it's kind of analogous to, imagine we had back in this experiment, but instead of throwing or shooting a beam of light at it, I had a million tennis balls. So I had this wall here, and I had a bucket full of a million tennis balls, and I picked them up and threw them at the wall. I had a series of machines that they're just tennis ball firing machines, like the automatic servers they had. So they just fire all these tennis balls at the wall here. And so if you were, and imagine, so imagine we actually, so if you actually had a series of, you were here, or actually maybe make them all a glass ball, so you're behind, you can actually see these tennis balls coming, but you're not hit by them. Sorry? It's a very thick glass ball. So if you see all these balls coming, and there's enough of them, it'll seem like there's this continuous stream of balls, like it's hard to pick one ball out from another ball, it's just this wave of balls that comes through, and that's kind of analogous to what you have in this case here. You just get this sort of wave, this continuous wave of light. Because where each one of you is being bathed by light now, and uses the light from these artificial lights here. And we don't see that as being made up of individual clumps of light. It just seems like one continuous stream or wave of light coming through. So that's what happens in that case. But if we actually, in going back to the tennis ball case, we actually kind of slow down the number of tennis balls, will slow down how fast or the rate at which we're throwing the tennis balls at the glass wall, eventually you can pick out, say if we throw 10 tennis balls, you can hear one here, it'll go ping, hear another one here, it'll go ping, the third one, ping, the fourth one, example. So you actually see the individual kind of tennis ball hitting the wall. And just as you get that in that case, so you get this analogous thing with light, that if you actually turn down the intensity, there's this incredibly, incredibly, incredibly faint beam of light. What happens? You see individual particles of light hitting. So that suggests that, at least from this perspective, light is made up of tiny particles, which have the special name photons. So they're really localized packets of energy, because light is made up of pure energy. So that's kind of the idea of light we have. at least in this case. So obviously the idea is more complicated. There's the wave, nature of light, particle, nature of light. I won't worry about that for the moment. So let's look at another simple thought experiment. So this one is we're getting into more real quantum physics. So what we have is like you deduced the idea of something which, so we have, you have a perfect mirror. So you have a mirror at home, your bathroom, and you shine light on it and it reflects 100% of the light off. So let's look at a mirror, but it was made, say, at a factory. It was pretty imperfect, so it's not a very, very good mirror at all. It was kind of like a mirror, but a little bit faulty. And so this mirror, if we shine, get a flashlight, so instead of, 100% of the light getting reflected, because that's a 45-degree angle there, I should say. So the light angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection there. So instead of the light basically being bounced up here, 100% of it, that would be for a perfect mirror. Half of it is reflected, but half of it gets through, so half of the intensity. So if we have two light detectors here, we detect half the intensity there and half the intensity. So whenever you see kind of these pictures here, these cylinders there, kind of light into the light detectors. So this is this idea of really, it's a 50-50 mirror. It's a mirror that's only works half the time, roughly speaking. So realistically, what this would be, and I mean, they have a lot of these in laboratories. And when you go to the Institute for Quantum Computing on Monday, you'll actually see what they look like. And so there's kind of like mirrors, but they're not. They're very imperfect mirrors. So that's what we have. But what they actually, I mean, they kind of look, they do look like mirrors, but they're just not, I mean, not as smooth and don't reflect as much, obviously. But they're very similar. So that was showing a whole beam of light. Now, we can think of light as being about a tiny little particle of quants. In this case, we did have millions and millions and millions and millions of these photons, or little particles of light. So what if we have just one of these particles of light, and they go towards this half-silver mirror, this mirror that's kind of a bit faulty or imperfect. So it reflects half of an incident beam and transmits half of it. What quantum physics says is, so what we can do an experiment. This is science, let's do an experiment. So let's say we shine one of these photons, we have just some device, somehow we can get one photon and shine it directed towards the mirror. What happens is half silvered mirror. What we see is that if we do it 1,000 times, so do it once, repeat it, repeat it, repeat it, then what we'll find is 500 of these photons get reflected up and go towards that, and 500 will get transmitted and they'll go through to this detector here, because again, it just picks up the photons. And so really, if we look at it as a probability, it's really like a coin toss. We toss 1,000 coins, 500 will be head, 500 will be tails. Here, 500 go up, 500 get transmitted through. So what we have is really, so it's a 50-50 probability, where that each photon will actually get reflected and go up, or get transmitted and go through. So we might be thinking, well, is there something different about the individual photons that actually get reflected as opposed to those that are transmitted? It seems a very, very natural thing. So maybe there are two types of photons, and some just have a propensity or a desire to get reflected up. So they go here and get reflected up there. And the other half, maybe they just have a propensity or a desire to get transmitted. So they actually kind of get through the mirror here. So maybe there are some different types. So that's a very natural thing to think. The quantum physics actually tells us that it's false. And as far as we know, what quantum physics tells us is that all photons are absolutely identical. So apart if they have the same frequency or the same wavelength. So assuming all the photons there are the same color of light. So if that's the case, then all of the photons are exactly the same. And that there's nothing different. So they're identical photons, and there's actually nothing different between the ones that get reflected or the ones that get transmitted. So what quantum physics says is each individual photon goes there, and it's a completely, genuinely random event whether it decides to get transmitted and to go along to the detector horizontally or get reflected up and bounced off from the detector vertically. And we'll see a little bit more about that later on. But that's actually an incredibly, incredibly deep, profound result. That it's just a random thing. Each individual photon will genuinely, randomly decide to either get transmitted or reflected. And what that means is no matter how good a scientist you are or an experimenter you are, there's absolutely no way in principle, according to quantum physics, to predict if I have one photon, whether it will get reflected or transmitted. And that's kind of a strange thing, because in science we're used to predicting things and predicting the results of experiments. But at this individual quantum level, quantum physics says, no, we cannot predict things. And there's actually a very familiar example of this. I talked about the americium in your smoke detector. So some of you may have a smoke detector or a smoke alarm at home. A number of those have actually americium, which is a radioactive element. And that radioactive elements are unstable, so they decay spontaneously, like uranium, for example. And quantum physics says if you have an individual radioactive atom, you cannot predict exactly when it will decay. It's a random, genuinely random thing. So if it was completely random, where there's no way we could predict anything, then, well, it'd be kind of bad. There'd be nothing for physics to do, because physics is like predicting things. So even if we can't predict an individual photon, what will happen like that? If we have 1,000 photons, then we have some rules, and they're the rules of quantum physics that we'll see in a little while. You can make really accurate predictions about where they will go. And so in particular, you can say if you have 1,000 photons, we can use the rules of quantum physics to say, yep, definitely, 500 of them will go up, and 500 will go across. So these are ways you could absolutely do this. So you could kind of predict overall statistical or ensemble behavior. But individually, at this level, no, it's a genuinely fundamentally random event. Okay, so let's look at another thing. Let's add some mirrors. So again, these could be mirrors that we've just stolen from home or bought from a shop. Not that I encourage, no, I shouldn't say that. We don't encourage you to steal. So we bought legally from a shop somewhere, and we have a mirror here, and a mirror here. So photons are ultimately a light. So actually, I should get the angles right. So they're all meant to be kind of 45 degree angles, if that makes sense. So we have the light coming in here, and this is... Obviously, so. So this is the half silvered mirror that I was talking about. And that's if it does get reflected, it goes from here up there. And it's really the angle of incidence, 45 degrees, is the same as the angle of reflection. So that's why it goes in that direction. Sorry. Okay, so this is what we have. So if a photon gets transmitted, and it goes along here, hits the mirror, it bounces up and goes along this path, so there's one path here. If it gets reflected, up here, bounces across and up there. So these sort of dotted lines indicate a possible path for the photon, this individual particle of light. And again, so just added a little layer of complexity. So we'll add one more now. So what we're going to do, and this is an activity for you, so what we're going to do is add another of these half-silvered mirrors, so these imperfect or faulty mirrors. And so what happens with just one here, so we put one photon in, each of them has a 50% chance of going along this path, 50% chance of going along that path, and if we had a photon going along here, this also would have a 50% chance of getting reflected, and a 50% chance of getting transmitted. But if we have a photon coming from below, because it could get transmitted and come up here, this also has a 50% chance of getting reflected and a 50% chance of getting transmitted. Yes? Sorry, if we've got a question here, are the two mirrors...
Are those fully silvered
mirrors? Yes, those are fully silvered mirrors. So, yeah, that's a good point. So... Actually, can I just have, I'll give you, so actually that's a good point. There are differences between this and this. So these are half silver mirrors, and I probably should have used a different color for them. So, okay. fetch. Okay, so guys, so these ones here are, these are the half silver mirrors. So these are different to these ones here are different to those two there. So these are fully silver mirrors. So given this, so now I've given you the basic idea of what happens. What I'd like you to do, and these blue cylinders are like text, what I'd like you to do, and I think some of you have already started, is tell me what, if we do this experiment and we shine 1,000 photons, one after another after another, what's the probability, or how many of those 1,000 photons will end up there, and how many of those 1,000 photons will end up there? So I'd like you to calculate that now. So I'm looking for a number, and that could be 700 will end up there, and 300 will end up there, or 200 there, and 800 there. So obviously the number will add up to 1,000. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And then write the answers down on the whiteboard. In big. Okay. Oh, great. Just, yeah, take a cat on the back. Do you understand the question? You've got your answers. Okay, okay, one more minute. You got your answer? Why? So 100% there or there? But how can I have 100%? That's 200%. You can't put in 1,000 photons against 2,000 now. Kind of okay. So everyone's got their answer? Okay, can everyone put their answer up? Okay. 500 because of symmetry, 500 each detector. So what do you say? 500, yes. Okay. Oh, there's a few people. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Four. So there's four people that say 1,000. So most of the answer is 500 here and 500 there. And there's a few people that say 100%. So what I'd like you to do now, so we've got a bit of disagreement. What I'd like you, if you gave the answer 100%, 0%, I'd like you to find someone. So what I'd like you to do is find someone with a different answer with you, and then argue with them, and your goal is trying to convince them of your answer. So I'll give you 4 minutes to do that. Find someone with a different answer to you. So there's 100 over there, there's 100 people at the back. Find one of those. Yes. 100%. You're 100%. Okay, there's 100% over here. 100% over there. 100%. Any more? Hey, what? Do you actually okay, you have, what, you got 50-50? Okay, why? Convince each other. Depends on what? Oh, but that's what one of you said, so we're assuming. Okay, so you want them to 100%. Okay, they're over there. Okay, 3 minutes. So what did you get? Is someone up there? I told you to want 100% people by next day. Maybe you've got to think of what you want to play, and you've got to talk to fear with each other. No, we can see each other. We want to make sure we have 100% of one of the and 0% of the other objectives. Is that convincing? Well, there is a little bit of a lack of symmetry because isn't there a lack of symmetry because the way it's going to be if you had another photon, okay, but these are just really they are. I think the way that many might get their mirrors, but they just. But I think the most, I mean, you could think of making weird mirrors that have different reflections, but the most, I mean, the standard thing is that you do that is the most, I mean, the most intuitive person there are, normally there's something in the trouble, you know, there's a reflection. If I have a rope and I hold one end, you can hold one end, then can I wriggle it up and down? Right. No, okay, that's enough time. Okay, good. Okay, so what I would like you to do now, okay, did anyone change their answer? Okay, so actually, if you could, are those of you that actually, everyone, could you just cross out your old answer and write your new answer now? If you haven't changed that, then don't worry, that's obviously not relevant. But if you could just write the new answer down, and then we'll just see, I'll just kind of get a snapshot of whether it's different. So you guys changed from 50-50 to 100? So somewhere you've got convinced. Okay, right. So... okay, so can everyone raise up the new answers now? 100%. Okay. It's a little bit weird. It's a little bit weird to come to flexibility of basis for a while. Because it's an amplitude. Both are exact physical details. Okay. The correct answer is. So it's not the. So this is again. This experiment has been done thousands of times. You go to the Institute for Quantum Computing. They've done it many times. Ask them what results they would get in this experiment. The correct answer is 100% there and 0% there. So
why?
Okay. To understand why, you need to understand the math of quantum physics. So we'll go through. So I'll explain that. Yes.
So it can be 100 at the top
when
it's 0 on the side?
No, not in this particular experiment. You could modify it slightly to get that. But I'll basically after lunch I'll be explaining why you get this. So So we have a question?
Will the result remain the same by moving one of the mirrors?
Will the result change? No, it won't. It'll actually change the result. So essentially this is, it's an interference phenomena. And what you get is, so photons have a wave-like aspect. So the 30-second explanation is, you actually get two possibilities for coming here, and they constructively interfere, like two water waves adding together, and you get 100%. And the two possibilities here are like two water waves destructively interfering, a trough and crescent. And so they cancel each other out, and you actually get 0%. So, but the thing is, this is a weird quantum result. And so this is one of the strange things. And so the intuitive answer, the answer that most people got, the answer that makes sense from our common sense point of view, is 50-50. And if you did this but changed the experiment to tennis balls or basketballs or something like that, it would be 50-50. And just the fact that, really the fact of why this is happening is these photons have a wave-like aspect, and it's an interference phenomenon. So it's a very strange thing. And so what we'll do now is we'll exactly go through all the math for this result. So quantum theory gives 100% there and 0%. So what I do is, why this happens, so we're almost at lunch break, I'll just go through this descriptive hand-wavy explanation, and then afterwards we'll go through the math. So each individual photon, so one way of looking at it is what a very natural way of looking at it is each individual photon when it gets to this sort of being this half-silvered mirror here. So I said, well, you'll measure 500 of them to be there and 500 to be there, and that's true. But what it seems is before we actually measure them, a very natural way of looking at it is that each of individual photon, in some sense, takes kind of both paths, goes along here and along there.
At the same time?
At the same time. So this is an example, this is a very weird quantum thing. But the thing is, well, how does that happen? Because how can it take, if it takes both paths, then when we have two detectors here and here, when we go back to this experiment, shouldn't we actually see both of the detectors going off? So then, you know, that makes sense. And well, the answer that quantum physics gives is kind of a strange answer is, Well, it is no, but it's just as it takes both paths until we actually decide to see which path it is taking. We actually decide to measure it. And when that happens, it instantly kind of collapses all the possibilities or changes it. So that exactly. So because we've only ever got one, we only ever put one photon in the experiment. So we're only going to ever measure one photon out. You never see an experiment where you magically double the number of photons. So we can only measure one photon. But it's as if it takes sort of both paths. And as soon as we look at it, as soon as we have the detector in its path, it basically kind of collapses or instantaneously changes from taking both paths into taking one definite path. And it turns out which path it does just could be 50% this one, 50% that one. So it's kind of as if, this is weird, this is very strange, but it's kind of as if we're not, as if when we're not looking at the photon, it's taking both paths, but as soon as we look at it, it kind of collapses or goes to being one of those paths, and it's actually random whether it's this one or that one. So this is kind of what we have, and we'll go through the mathematics of this in detail and see how. Yes? Right, yeah, so that's a good question. This gets kind of onto subtle things. So two answers to that. One, we could say, okay, we're a theoretical physicist, so we're doing this in complete vacuum in the middle of space, so we don't have to worry about things like that. And I'm talking about simplifying things. That's why it's good to be a theoretical physicist, because you can assume stuff like that. So that's one answer. And two answers, so in reality, when you go, for example, the Institute of Quantum Computing, they have these experiments. And so obviously they don't have a perfect vacuum. And so what happens is that's kind of like measuring it, but it's not, it's kind of like slightly measuring it. So what that is just slightly collapses things. So slightly. And so in that case, in these actual experiments, you don't end up getting, 100% and 0%, but you get something like 95% and 5%. So it's yeah, exactly. Perfect vacuum. So, yeah. When we do the thought experiment, they always turn out perfectly. So that's the idea. So, okay, we haven't looked at it. We're not looking at right for the end. So, each photon takes both paths. So it goes there and there. And so we get a photon going from here along this path, one going from there, reaching that detector. And then again, they're like, they constructively interfere with each other. So let's look at the ways to get to this top detector here. There's this path here and this path, two possibilities. But this is kind of weird quantum physics. So they both happen at the same time. And so this is, you can see the two paths together. So what that happens is that they kind of, so the two paths, if they both happen at the same time, they have to kind of be overlaid or overlapped upon each other. And when they actually do that, turns out if you go through the math, because this photon has been reflected here once and reflected here twice, and what that does is actually gives us an extra phase. Explain what I mean by that, but it means that kind of the photons taking the two paths, the red and the black one, they're out of sync with each other. So more technically, they're out of phase by pi. So they're really like a water wave that is sort of a crest and a trough. And if you get those combining with each other, they cancel each other out. And you actually get a node. So get that. So that's kind of, they're destructively, so they cancel each other out. And you get 0% up there. And basically what happens is these two guys, or these two possibilities are in sync. You get the possibility of the photon going here, and up there, and there. But remember, they happen at the same time, because the photon takes both paths, and then actually gets more complicated. Then each, the red path and the black path, they each split up into two paths. So you get two possibilities and four possibilities, and all four happen at the same time, but I'm just showing two because we neglected the other, so I really should have two more lines pointing up there. But these ones happen, well, this gets transmitted once and reflected once. And this is reflected once and transmitted once. So each of them only gets reflected once and transmitted once. So basically it goes through the same process to get to here. And so that means they're in sync with each other. And so they're in phase with each other, so they overlap. And they constructively interfere. And so this is why we get this result. So I know this is kind of hand-wavy at the moment, but again, so even if you don't believe everything I'm saying, you can actually go to the experiments and you can see those. So, and so the analogous thing, I'll take questions in a minute, just do this slide. The analogous thing is if you get a pond, you get two stones in a pond, and you just drop them in, you get ripples spreading out. And if you look at certain points in the ripple pattern, you actually get a peak and a peak from a wave overlap, just as I was talking about. And you get constructive interference, and you get a higher wave. You get more amplitude and energy there. And there are some points in the pattern where you get peak and a trough or out of phase combining with each other, and you get destructive interference. The water's pretty still. And so you get this pattern, constructive, destructive, sort of a lot of energy. And so this is basically, just as we get back with ripples, we're getting exactly the same thing here, except this is like a trough, crest and a crest, constructive, and this is like destructive interference. So does anyone have any questions? Yes?
Why is it particularly at P that it will be constructive and at A it will be destructive all the time?
Right, yep, excellent question. So we'll see again in details exactly why mathematically, but so the point is, so these are the two possibilities that go to creating here and here. And what happens is they actually go through the same, if you like, they go through the same procedure, or they go through the same series of events. So here, going from here, the black part, that involves one transmission because the photon gets transmitted through there. And it just bounces off the mirror, so don't worry about that. And it gets to here, and it gets reflected off. So it hits here, then it bounces off, and goes like that, gets reflected off. So it goes one transmission, one reflection, we counted those. And what happens to the other one? Well, it's exactly the same thing, except the reverse order. But the order doesn't really matter, it's just there's one transmission, one reflection. And so they go through the same process, so they're in sync with each other. So if they're in sync with each other, they basically are like two water waves that come from two different sources.
And the other one is reflected twice and the other one is transmitted.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
You've got it. Yes?
So if we were to change the light source or photon source to actually come from the bottom, then you would collect 100% of the other sensors?
Exactly. You've got it. Yep. Yes?
So then you become called phase because the mood changes, is it?
Yes, exactly.
So it only becomes out of phase because one takes a slightly longer path, one takes a slightly shorter path.
You can design it where that happens, but it's actually not. The paths are exactly the same. Every photon takes the same path.
Why is that a phase difference?
Right, because you actually get a phase difference upon reflection, just as you do if you have a rope and you turn a rope up and down. So it's that. We'll actually see why, but when it's like a wave getting reflected, it picks up a phase. Yes?
When the photons are out of sync, am I supposed to
construct a new one? Sorry, I can't hear the question.
When the photons are out of sync, how does it change the nature of the photons so that it constructs an interference?
Right, so what it does, so in technical terms, it changes the phase of them. And what I'm going to do is go through after lunch is show you exactly the mathematics. But in the mathematics, what it does is it gives an extra. Gives an extra phase of that value. So that won't kind of make any sense now, but by the end of an afternoon, we should. Okay, so what we'll do now is... Okay, so if everyone's really, really quiet, we'll go to lunch. Okay. Okay, so I think there's a lot of people discussing things, so we'll take a break, and we'll continue this after lunch. I'm going to go to the next one.